All right, we're going to start here about 14 lines from the bottom of Yud Gimel Amud Bet. The Gemara says, Tano, smicha, u'smichat zekenim b'gimel. So the Mishnah tells us that smicha and smichat zekenim is with three. My smicha, u'my smichat zekenim. So Gemara wants to know, what are these two options in the Mishnah? One of them we've already discussed, which is the need for there to be zekenim, or three zekenim from the Sanhedrin Gdolah to represent the Sanhedrin with regards to the Par Helam Dover Shel Tzibor. So we know what one of them means. The real question is, what does the other one mean? So I'm Rabbi Yochanan Mismach Save, that the reference here in the Mishnah is to the smicha of the Save here means of the elders. But the smicha that we're speaking about here is not the smicha that we know of today, rather the smicha that we know from the Gemara with regards to smicha of passing the torch from generation to generation from Moshe Rabbeinu, that really grants the individual the right or the authority to adjudicate cases. And mostly, or the big function that they have, is the ability to do that with regards to knesot, which we'll see is a pivotal factor, as well as to deal with capital cases when there is a Sanhedrin Agdolah in place. So the smicha is what we're speaking about here, and the passage of smicha from the party who has smicha to the party that they're trying to give the smicha to requires three individuals. Now, it's not clear here that you actually need three smuchim to do it. You don't need three individuals who have smicha to pass it. You just need one person with smicha and then three individuals together, according to many, which is that the other two individuals don't actually have to have smicha. They just have to be there to constitute the three for the granting of smicha. There are those that do require a full three smuchim in order to pass the smicha to the next generation. Some of the Abayda of Yosef, mismach sabe b'shlosha minolan. What's the source for the fact that you actually need three people to convey the smicha? If you say, because the pasuk says, by Moshe Rabbeinu, when he's conveying smicha or the leadership mantle to Yeshua Binun, it says that he placed his hands on Moshe Rabbeinu. In that case, it should be sufficient with one individual, meaning that it should be just like Moshe Rabbeinu. If you want to say that Moshe Rabbeinu replaced the Beit Din of 71, either because he sat atop that Beit Din, or because in future generations, many of the roles that Moshe Rabbeinu played are taken over by the Sanhedrin Agdolah. So in that case, you would say Moshe Rabbeinu is the equivalent or equal to the Beit Din of 71. Then in order to convey or confer smicha on an individual, you would have to actually have 71 to do it. So we have sources for the fact that it could be one, or a possible source for the fact that it'd be 71. Where do you get the fact that it should be three? Gemara leaves it as a kasha. That is an unresolved issue. They have a misora, or that's the way that the practice was to do it, three, but they don't have a direct source for understanding how it was done with three, or where they know that it's done with three. So I'm like Rav Acha Brei D'Rava, the Ravashi. So now with regards to this smicha, he asks Ravashi, do you have to actually physically do it? Place your hands on the individual. When we speak about smicha here, how close is this to the smicha that we're speaking about with regards to korbanot, where the individual places their hands on the animal itself, as well as with Moshe Rabbeinu, when he's conferring smicha or the mantle of leadership to Yeshua Binun, it sounds like that he actually physically placed his hands on Yeshua's head. So the smicha that we're speaking about here, how similar in nature is it to that, and does it require physical contact between the Someich and the Nismach? That's not a physical conferment on the individual, but rather in name. He gives him the title of Rabbi, and that's why in the Gemara, people who have smicha have the term or the accolade that goes in front of their name of Rabbi, and those without smicha are just known by their names in the Gemara. Second of all, they're also granted the right to be done dine knasot, to deal with fines and penalties that are not equivalent to reparations or the replacement of losses that are generated, that you have the right to do only if you have smicha. Rashi over here discusses, in Bavel they adjudicated certain manners in certain cases, and how does that relate to this requirement of smicha? So Rashi over here says that in the beginning of the parak, we discussed the problems of nilat delet, the problem of closing the door in the credit markets, and that's why we allowed the adjudication of certain monetary cases with just three individuals, not having the requirement of smuchim. In addition, In cases where we don't have that problem of closing up the credit markets, these are monetary matters or issues where you're depositing with individuals or theft. In those cases, we're not talking about issues of closing down a credit market, but these are issues where there's monetary loss that is caused. Over there, Dainin in Bavel, Afagav Delecha Smicha. In Bavel, they still did this even without Smicha. It's a principle that the Gemara lays out, which is that we act on behalf of the Sumuchim in Eretz Yisrael. So in Eretz Yisrael, they empower the Batei Dinim outside of Eretz Yisrael to adjudicate these matters, but it's only in matters that involve monetary loss. In matters where, if we didn't do this, we would create a society or we'd create a situation in which people would not have any deterrent from stealing, from taking other people's property, from doing things that would cause losses to other people because there would be no repercussions to their actions. And so therefore, we act on behalf of the Batei Dinim, or the Smuchim in Eretz Yisrael, in Bavel to adjudicate that. Aval, b'knasa lo avdinan shluchutayu. When it comes to a knas, we don't act on their behalf. Bishom delo shchicha. It's not something that's so common. V'leit ba chisaron kis. And there's no loss there, because obviously a fine or a penalty is not usually, in a sense, reparations or restoration or remuneration for something that was done, but rather it's a penalty that's levied on top of that, either as a deterrent or as a punishment for what they did. So in that case, the Beit Batei Dinim and Bavel are not empowered to deal with that. So smicha confers the right on the individual to deal with dinei knasot, and also confers the individual to gain the title of rabbi, which means that he can be posek, he can give direction, he has a certain stature and standing. What we have in Bavel is a derivative of that, which is those people in Bavel who are acting don't have smicha, and their batei dinim there are functioning almost as satellites or derivatives of the smuchim in Eretz Yisrael. And so what Rashi points out to us is that in matters that deal with the credit markets, the Gemara already said we waive the need for smuchim, that's anywhere. With regards to knasot, we do not waive the necessity for smicha, and that's because we're not dealing with monetary losses, we're dealing with penalties and fines, and that the batei dinim without smicha do not have the right to deal with. The one area in between, which technically the batei dinim in Bavel should not be able to deal with, which are theft, monetary losses, and deposits, things like that, nevertheless, the batei dinim in Eretz Yisrael empowered, the smuchim in Eretz Yisrael empowered the batei dinim in Bavel in order to have a functioning society, a just society, allow them to adjudicate those cases, even though technically they should require smuchim. Nevertheless, we act as proxies for the smuchim in Eretz Yisrael, and that's how they can adjudicate those cases in Bavel. Now the Gemara says, v'chad lo samich? Is it really true that one individual cannot confer smicha on a student? V'hama Rav Yehuda Amar Rav Biram Zachor Oto Ish L'Tov. We should remember this individual in a positive light. Rav Yehuda Ben Bava Shemo. And Rav Yehuda Ben Bava is his name. Rav Yehuda Ben Bava lives in the period of time probably of the Hadrianic persecutions, just we'll see in a second, from the priests that we see. But he lives in that period of time between the Churban HaBayit and the end of the Mered Bar Kokhba. He did see the Beit HaMikdash while it was still extant in his younger years, and he lived long enough to deal with many of the Talmidim here we're going to see of Rabbi Akiva. So at the point in time that this story is taking place, he's got to be an individual who's at least in his 90s, if not close to 100, in terms of his age, vis-a-vis what we know about him and stories that we know about him. So he was very advanced in age, especially for the time period in which he's living, which is that he's spanning over a period of time that includes three or four generations of individuals. He's also known, the Gemara says, that in any time the Gemara uses the term or the generic term, Maseh b'chassid echad, the Gemara over there gives two individuals that it could possibly be referencing to, and one of them is Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. So he's known for his righteousness, his chassidut, he's known for his erudition, and famously here, he's known for the story with regards to smicha. And so over there it says, if it were not for this individual, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, shumalehu, if it were not for him, nishtachachu dinei knasot miYisrael, then all these issues of fines would have been forgotten from Klal Yisrael. Gemara says, nishtachachu, they would have been forgotten, nigrasinu, just learn them. You can teach them, we can work out what these issues are. Why do we need him? And if you're talking about conveyance of information, there are other individuals who have this. What was so important about Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava with regards to the learning of manners that deal with knasot? Ella, but lu dine knasot misof. If it were not for him, there would no longer be anybody who could adjudicate cases that deal with knasot, or in essence, there would not be any more smicha in Klal Yisrael. Shepamachat gazra malchut erishag zera Yisrael, the terrible nation decreed on Klal Yisrael. And usually here, when you have a reference to Machut HaRishah, that refers to Rome or Edom. And here, when they're talking about Gzera al Yisrael, that a lot of times deals with the time period of the Hadrianic persecutions, where there were tremendous, difficult decrees that are placed on the Jews in order to remove any semblance of religious life or to stop the ability of the Jews there to continue to practice their religion and be a problem, in essence, for the Roman governorship there. Shekola Sumech Yareg. This was the decree. Anybody who gives, conveys, confers smicha will be killed. Shekola Nismach. And the recipient of that smicha, Yareg, will also be killed. Ve'ir shesomchim ba. And here is the deterrent, which is, if you want to take that risk, an individual wants to decide that it's worth the risk to convey the smicha or confer the smicha, so they'll take the risk. And the recipient will take the risk. But it's not just you that's at risk, because here, shesomchim ba techarev. Whatever city that you do this in, that entire city will be wiped out. Utchumim shesomchim ben yeakru. And anything within the tchum of that area, within they call it the borders of that city, will be overturned. Maybe it means the fields, maybe it means the trees, the vegetation, but they're going to destroy everything in that area. So here's a huge disincentive from getting involved in smicha. Masa, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. So what did Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava to deal with this do? Halach v'yashav lo ben shnei harim gidolim. He sat between two large mountains. U'ben shnei ayarot gidolot. In between two large cities. U'ben shnei tchumei shabbat. In between the two tchumei shabbat. So he put himself outside of the city limits of these two areas. Ben Usha l'shefram. Between Usha and Shefram, both of them are in the Galil HaTachton. These are places that are mentioned in the travelings of the Sanhedrin, that the Sanhedrin moved for a number of places after Yavne. Two of the places it moved to, one was Usha, and then later on Shparam, and they're both obviously Jewish cities. And so what he did was he placed himself in a location that could not be associated with any city. He made himself independent of any city, and he placed himself between two mountains. That could be for one of two reasons. That could either be for visibility, so that they wouldn't see him doing this, or it could be because that was the location that put him outside the city limits of these two cities, which are, according to what I read, about 3 kilometers away from each other, and that they did find in the areas over there a cave that has the Greek inscription in there saying that Adkan Tchum Shabbat for Usha. So they have a sense of where the city limits and the Tchum Shabbat were for Usha. And so he placed himself in that mountainous area that sat between these two cities in order to protect the cities from being caught up in what he was about to do. Samach sham chamisha zikinim, and there he conveyed or conferred smicha to 5 zikinim, ve'elohim, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yossi, ve'Rabbi Elazar ben Shamua. So these are some of the big Tanaim that we see generally in the Mishnayot and in many of the Tanaic works that we bump into. These are the main individuals that are found in them, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Shimon, and Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Elazar ben Shemua, Rabbi Avya Mosif, after Rabbi Nechemiah was included in this. These individuals also happen to be Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva. So that's interesting too, because if they're Talmidim of Rabbi Akiva, how does Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava get into the story? And the Gemara asks that question in a minute. Kamen Shikiroi Vehem Behen, once the enemies got wind of what was going on, whether that's somebody discovered them, somebody tattled on them, somehow the information got out. Amar lehen benai rutsu. He says to the Talmidim, run. Amrulo Rebbe matei alecha. What about you, Rebbe? Obviously he couldn't run. Given the advanced age that he was at, it would be impossible for him to outrun the Roman army at that point. And so he basically was resigned to the fact that he was going to lose his life in this. Amar lehem hareni mutal lifnehem ke'even she'en lahufchim. I'm like a stone in front of them that nobody can turn over. Meaning that I'm not afraid of them. He's lived a long life. He's someone who's experienced and seen a lot in his lifetime, including the Churban HaBayit. And he's someone who has a mission here. His mission is to perpetuate the smicha and pass it to his students. So he has successfully done that, and he sees that as being a mission that he's now accomplished, where he can say to them, go, and if I get killed, it's not a big deal. I'm a stone that they can't do anything. They can't, in essence, kill me anymore, because I've now, in conferring with you, with the smicha, passed on what I have. And so I have a certain amount of eternity now because of the ability of you to continue that which I've done. Amru lo zazu misham, ad shin atzu bo shlosh me'ot lunbiot is one girsa, the other one is lunkiot, shel barzel vasu ke kavara. The story goes that he didn't leave there until the Roman army reached there, and that they plunged into him 300 lunbiot or lunkiot. Rashi translated as chanitot or chanit, which is a spear. Although from the way that Rashi is describing it, it seems more like a smaller instrument, more like a dagger of sorts. Whereas the oruch, and it's quoted here on the side by the Masoret HaShas, says that they are romach, which would be a spear. So they had thrown 300 spears or daggers into him. Vasu kikavara, they made him like a sieve, because there were so many holes or so many punctures in him. Obviously, the idea being that he was passive. Like he said here, he's like a stone. He wasn't going anywhere. He wasn't moving. And so the Romans caught him and killed him. He was outnumbered and outrun by a long way. And that's what's described here. But he again stated that he had already accomplished his mission, which was to give smicha to these individuals. And therefore, he felt like he had accomplished what he was supposed to accomplish, because otherwise smicha would be lost. So the Gemara asked about this. How is it possible that Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava in the story is the sole conferrer of smicha, if we require more than one individual or three individuals to pass smicha on? So Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, achrina havu ba'adei. Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava was not alone. There were other individuals with him. The reason they don't mention them is because of the honor of Yehuda ben Bava, meaning that he so outshone them, or was so much greater than them, that in essence they were irrelevant. They were just a number to get the three. He was the main player here in terms of what happened. It's also possible that the other two individuals that were with him were younger and able to run. And so he was the only one in the end who was caught by the Roman army, versus the Nismachim, who were able to run away, who were younger, as well as the other individuals who accompanied him to make it possible to do the smicha. So like we mentioned before, the possibility here is that you don't need three smuchim in order to do this. If that's the case, it actually could be the nismachim. Some of the individuals who were getting smicha could be in the numbers of the three to get you to the three. Or you have to say that there were other smuchim that joined Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, but they were not as famous or as great as Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava. So now the Gemara asks, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava, samche? Rabbi Meir, was Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava really the one who gave him smicha? V'amar Rabba Barbar Chana, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Kolomer Rabbi Meir, lo samcho Rabbi Akiva, anybody who says that Rabbi Akiva didn't give smicha to Rabbi Meir is mistaken. Where it says, Samchei Rabbi Akiva, velo kiblo. That he did give him smicha. Rabbi Akiva conferred smicha, gave him ordination. But the way Rashi says over here, velo kiblo, lemvisha daina ya bachur. When Rabbi Akiva gave it to him, or gave him the ordination, it was when he was still very young. And therefore he wasn't accepted, which is very interesting here, because that adds an additional dimension to smicha, which is that the idea of smicha, it's not enough that the person who is the samuch grants you the right of smicha. There has to be a certain amount of acceptance of the individual as a samuch. So you both need the technical smicha, which is someone who has smicha has to confer it on you. Besides that, you do need permission from the nasi that we saw earlier in order to give smicha. But more importantly, it seems you need to have an acceptance amongst the kahal or amongst the rabbanim in general, that the smicha that was conferred on you by the individual who was samuch, that now they accept that and now you have smicha. It seems here that because Rabbi Meir was so young when Rabbi Akiva gave him smicha, that he wasn't well accepted or wasn't granted to him or it didn't follow through. And therefore, after he already got in smicha from Rabbi Akiva, then Samchei Rabbi Akiva lo kiblo, Samchei Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava v'kiblo. Afterwards or later on, Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava gives him smicha and there it was accepted. And that might have to do with the fact that Rabbi Meir was then older, or it might have to do with the direness of the situation. Maybe when he was younger, there were many more smuchim around, and therefore they didn't need him to be a samuch, or they didn't accept him as a samuch. By this time, it's clear that there are very few people left with smicha, and it becomes essential for him to have smicha in order to pass on the torch of smicha, because otherwise they're going to lose this continuous chain of individuals from Moshe Rabbeinu in the granting of smicha. Amar Rabbi Yishuv ben Levi, Ein smicha b'chutz l'aretz. There is no such thing as smicha outside of Eretz Yisrael. Ma ein smicha? What does it mean there's no such thing? If you say, not that there's no smicha outside of Eretz Yisrael, but you can't practice the things that a samuch has the right to do outside of Eretz Yisrael, which means then you wouldn't be able to be done dinei knasot outside of Eretz Yisrael. Vatnan. Sanhedrin noheged ben ba'aretz ben b'chutz la'aretz. That the Sanhedrin can sit both in Eretz Yisrael and in chutz la'aretz. Now, if the Sanhedrin could sit in chutz la'aretz, that means that they could adjudicate dealings of knasot. If that's the case, then there is application outside of Eretz Yisrael. Ela delo samchinan b'chutz la'aretz. We don't grant, we don't confer ordination smicha outside of Eretz Yisrael. So the Gemara explains that pshita somchim b'chutz la'aretz v'nismachim ba'aretz. If the person who has smicha is in chutz la'aretz and they're trying to confer on someone in Eretz Yisrael smicha, haminan delo. You just told us that it doesn't work, that there's an inability to confer smicha when you're in chutz la'aretz. Ela somchim b'aretz v'nismachim b'chutz la'aretz. What happens if the people who have smicha are in Eretz Yisrael and they want to grant smicha to someone who is outside of Eretz Yisrael? My, what's the din there? Now, that can happen in one of two ways. That the Gemara will explore in a second, but the two possibilities are that you're standing on the border, which is that one of them is in Eretz Yisrael and the other one's in Chutz La'aretz. Obviously, that's a wild case or a far-fetched case, but it's trying to demonstrate the limits of smicha. Or the question really can come from, and what seems to be what the Gemara is asking over here is, if you have smuchim in Eretz Yisrael who are aware of individuals in Chutz La'aretz who they want to grant smicha to, who they want to give ordination to, can they do it even though they're not present? Do you have to be physically present to get the smicha, or can they confer smicha even if the individual is not present, is not there? The Gemara says, Tashma, Rabbi Yochanan haya mitzta'er alei Rabbi Shimon bar Abba, lo hagabayu lilismichei. Rabbi Yochanan was despondent about the fact that one of his talmidim, Rabbi Shimon bar Abba, was not present, wasn't near him, delismichei, so that he could give him smicha. So you see over here that there is this need for physical proximity in order to grant smicha. Because if it wasn't necessary, then Rabbi Yochanan could have conferred that smicha to him even though he wasn't present. So the fact that he was upset about it and he didn't succeed at it shows you that you need physical presence or proximity in order to convey the smicha. Now, Rabbi Shimon ben Zirud v'chadimei, uman Rabbi Yonatan ben Achmai, v'amila Rabbi Yonatan ben Achmai v'chadimei, uman Rabbi Shimon ben Zirud. So these are two individuals who were peers and seemingly of a similar nature, a similar level of erudition. Chadavu gabayu samchu. One of them who was in Eretz Yisrael and was present, they gave smicha to. Chadlo davu gabayu lo samchu. And the other one who was not there, was not present, they did not give smicha to. So over here, you see the necessity or the need for presence in order to get smicha. So again here, these are additional qualifications for the granting of smicha. So far we said that one requirement is that you have someone who's samuch to grant the smicha. That's number one. Number two is you have to have three individuals in order to convey the smicha. Number three is you need permission from the nasi in order to grant smicha. And then lastly, now we see that there's an additional requirement that it be done in Eretz Yisrael. That it must be in Eretz Yisrael. And you have to be proximate. You have to be present, physically present, in order for you to get the smicha. So that makes it that there's a certain association with smicha and Eretz Yisrael. The explanation of that might be one, is that there's a certain amount of, we call it, Ruach HaKodesh, or Avira de Eretz Yisrael Machkim, however you want to describe it, that there's something unique or special about Eretz Yisrael that allows for smicha to be passed there, and doesn't exist in Chutz La'aretz. The other possibility is that it relates to a certain amount of Jewish autonomy, as well as Jews living in their land, and that the Sanhedrin has to be b'moshevotechem, in the place that you dwell. Now, generally, when we look at moshevotechem, it means any place a Jew is found, just like we learned that by the Gabbai Shabbat. Lotuvarueish b'chol moshevotechem, b'yom ha-shabbat, moshevotechem there means anywhere you dwell. But over here, some take the literal sense of Moshe Votechem to only relate to Eretz Yisrael, and therefore only in the settlements of Eretz Yisrael, or where Jews are present in Eretz Yisrael, do we have this smicha? So now, the smicha, or the smicha that is spoken about here in the Gemara, we see from Rabbi Yehuda ben Bava the great lengths he went to in order to preserve the smicha and to keep it going. Unfortunately, that doesn't last forever. Our enemies were successful at reducing the number of smuchim that we had, as well as eventually causing it to be very difficult to pass the smicha to the next generation. And then eventually this process of smicha is lost as the community in Eretz Yisrael dwindles and the number of Talmidei Chachamim and individuals that are found there almost come to the point where Eretz Yisrael is not a place of Torah anymore, and the center of Torah shifts to the Gaonim and in Bavel. And there is a loss of this passage of the smicha, whether that was unintentional, meaning that it happened because of the gzerot and the decrees, and the fact that the community in Eretz Yisrael slowly dies out, or is it something that was more intentional, which is that they stopped passing smicha because they felt that they no longer had the capacity or the ability to maintain the smicha, or the individuals who ra'oi the smicha, that's not clear, but there is a break in the passing of smicha to the point where today we do not have smicha. That's already back from the time of the Gaonim. We see that there's a loss of smicha. There was an attempt to restore smicha, to try to bring it back. It's based on the Rambam. The Rambam, when he writes about smicha, seems to give an option of what's called haskamat rabbinei or kol klal Yisrael. That smicha is either a direct line from Moshe Rabbeinu, which seems to be the primary way it's described here, as well as in the Rambam. The Rambam there makes a statement that makes it sound like, not everybody reads it that way, that you can also have smicha be where everybody agrees that a certain individual is worthy of smicha. As the Rambam says in Hilchot Sanhedrin, in Perek Dalet Halacha Yud Aleph, V'nirin li advarim, shim iskimu kol chachamim shveret Yisrael limnod dayanim, v'lis mochatam, hareilu smuchim. And so there was an attempt. It was a major machloket between Yerushalayim and Tzfat in the time of the Beit Yosef as to the attempt to restore smicha to Klal Yisrael. And they were going to do it through getting a consensus of all the Rabbanim in these areas in order to pass the smicha.
The attempt was led by the Mari Beirav out of Tzfat.
So, like many cases in political situations or situations like this, at that point in time, Tzfat was a major center of Jewish learning, so much so that Yerushalayim was almost a nothing in those days. Already at the time of the Churban HaBayit, the post of Churban HaBayit, the Jewish life had shifted to the north, and there was very little in the south, both because of the destruction wrought there, as well as the ease of which it connected either to Bavel or to the west, to Turkey, which made an easy connection between the communities in the Gola to those communities that were adjacent in Eretz Yisrael.
And so the Jewish community was found in the north, and even on the return, or when Jews are found in Eretz Yisrael, they tend to be found in the north in Tzfat. So Rav Yaakov Beirav, along with the other Rabbanim in Tzfat,
tried to reinstate the smicha, but they forgot to include the Rabbanim in Yerushalayim.
And then only informed the Rav Levi ben Chaviv in Yerushalayim, the Ralbach, after they had already done it.
And so the Rabbanim in Yerushalayim took issue with that, and they write strongly against this practice of smicha. They write halachically, meaning not just because they took offense to what happened, but they think halachically it's inappropriate. But one of the lines that they write is that if you need haskama of all the Rabbanim, I'm telling you that I'm not maskim. We're not maskim to it because we don't think it's right. And so in that, they, in one shot, undermined, got rid of this attempt to reinstate smicha in that time period, but is a very famous machloket in the time of the Beit Yosef as to whether they could or their attempt to restore smicha to Klal Yisrael.
And Rav Yosef Karo was amongst one of the four or five individuals who received smicha from Rav Yaakov Beirav, who's the original samuch that they gathered together and gave haskamah to make him into a samuch. And so Rav Yosef Karo was the recipient of that smicha from Rabbi Yaakov ben Chaviv. Now, interestingly enough, the attempt to reinstate smicha there had to do with the Inquisition and many of the Jews who had turned Moranos or had, in many senses, accepted upon themselves Christianity as part of the Inquisition, were then leaving those areas and coming back to Jewish communities. And based on some of the violations or sins that they had committed, they were chayav karet. And so what they wanted to do by reinstating Beit Din was allow a Beit Din to give corporal punishment, give Malkot. Because we know that anybody who's Chayiv Kritut, if they get Malkot, then they can remove the Chiyuv of Malkot. And so therefore they wanted to reinstate the Bati Dinim in order to facilitate this. And part of the worries of the Rabbanim in Yerushalayim were this feeling or sense that this had a Mishichist side to it, and it might lead to another false era of the Messiah, as well as maybe upset or provoke the ire of the Ottoman rulers at that time. So that ends the attempt in that time period in the mid-1500s to reinstate Smicha. There were other attempts, not as famous after that point, to try to reinstate Smicha, but so far none of them have been successful, all premised on this Rambam. And of course, there's a machloket about what the Rambam means. He himself is somewhat ambiguous in the remainder of that halacha, but based on that Rambam, there have been attempts to reinstate Smicha, all of which have failed so far.
Rabbi Chanina, Rabbi Oshaya, Avu Kamishtakeid, Rabbi Yochanan Mismichinu. Rabbi Yochanan was shokei, trying very hard to get them Smicha. Lava Mistaya Milto. It just didn't work out. The way Rashi writes, it didn't work out. There were technical problems. When the Nasi was around, they weren't around. When the Nasi wasn't around, they were around. It seems to be every time they tried to put it together, things just didn't work out. It wasn't for a lack of trying, but they couldn't get it organized in a way where they actually could get smicha. Rabbi Yochanan was very upset about this, that he was unable to convey the smicha to them. Amulei, no nitzar mar. They said to him, don't worry about it. Danan bi beit Eli katinan. We are descendants of Beit Eli, which means that they were Kohanim, but descendants of Beit Eli, just like Rabbo and Abaye were. Dama Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachman, Am Rabbi Yonatan minayin she'en nismachim lebeit Eli. How do you know that you do not convey smicha to someone who's from Beit Eli? Shinamar, the pasuk says, Lo yeh zakein b'veitecha kol hayamim. Says there will be nobody elderly in your household forever. My zakein. Ilayim is zakein mamash. If you think zakein means literally someone of advanced age, Vatev, the pasuk already makes a promise, Kol marbit b'techa yamutu anashim, that any person from your household will die when they're still anashim, when they're still young men. So then the promise already is, or the terrible decree was, that nobody would live past a young age. So then how could you be speaking about zakenim over here, literally, that there will be no zakenim? They're all dying young, of course there are no zakenim in from Beit Eli. Ella smicha, the zakenim over there must reference to smicha, to tell you that not only will they not live a long life, but they will not be successful at being nismach, his ordination, in the smicha. So they saw in that a fulfillment of the promise to Beit Eli that they would not be able to receive smicha, or the reason that it didn't work out that they got smicha was because they weren't entitled, or it would not happen that they were going to get smicha. Now the Gemara Rosh Hashanah tells the story of Abaye and Rabbo about the fact that they were also from Beit Eli, and they were not going to be able to live long lives. The Gemara there says that Torah and Gemilut Chasadim can overcome a portion of the decree. Because the Gemara says over there, B'zevav mincha eno mitchaper. It says there that through korbanot or any other offerings, that Beit Eli will not be mitchaper. Aval mitchaper hu b'torah hu b'gemilut chasadim. The Gemara is mitdayek from that they can't succeed through korbanot to attain kapara or a longer life, but through Torah gemilut chasadim they would have that success. And so over there it describes that Rabbo or Rovo, it's a machloket about the Girs over there, who was osek b'Torah, lived a long life. He lived till 40, and Abaye, who was not only osek b'Torah but also gemilut chasadim, lived until the ripe old age of 60. So there they saw the ability to overcome, at least in part, this decree of Beit Eli, but that's all they could do, which is overcome that curse of Beit Eli. What they could not overcome was the smicha part, and so that over here they see a fulfillment of that in the inability of Rabbi Yochanan to give smicha to Rabbi Chanina and Rabbi Oshaya. So now, Rabbi Zeva hari mitamer lemismichei. Rabbi Zeva was running away from the Nasi so that he couldn't give him smicha. He did not want to become a samuch. Dama Rabbi Elazar, lolam havi kaval, Vikayam. He says you should always be tsanua. You should be a no name, disappear from the public eye, and then you'll live a long life. And that there's a certain benefit to not being in these positions of leadership or these positions of adjudication where you're a samuch. So Rabbi Zera wanted to avoid the limelight in order that he could live a long life. He didn't want to be burdened with the problems that are associated with being a samuch because it would cut his life short. Came into Shama the Hadamar Belazar. But then he heard another member of Rabbi Elazar, A person that will not rise to be of stature unless they forgive all of his sins. Whether that's because Mina Shamayim, they would only grant him the right to become someone of stature if they believed he was worthy, if they believed that he wasn't a sinner, and therefore, by definition, this person must be Mochlim Lo Kol Avonotav. So rather than a statement that he would be forgiven of all his sins, it's a stamp of approval from the heavens that this person must be someone who is worthy of this honor. And so therefore, if you are Nismach, that would be indicative of the fact that you were not a sinner. Or it's possible that it is something that grants the individual a Mechilah. The Yerushalmi speaks about a Chacham, a Melech, and a Chatan, who are three individuals who all Mochlin Kol Avonotehem, that all their sins are forgiven. It might have to do with the fact that each of these individuals is changing their life at that point in time. It's as if they're being reborn. And like by a Chatan, where his life as a single individual is now ending, and his life as a married individual is now beginning, it's as if he's starting over again, as well as the fact that Gemara and Yerushalmi has a drasha about Talmidei Chachamim, connecting them to Geirim, and therefore the Talmid Chacham who's ordained is similar to a ger, which is kinok shenola dami, as if he's a newborn baby. And for that reason, they're considered to be as if they started with a clean slate. And that's what it means over here, mochlin lo kol avonotav, because you get an erasure of everything that happened prior to this time, because you're being born again, in a sense, you're starting a new life at this point in time. So once he heard that, amsilei anafshei, he made himself available so that he would get smicha, or he presented himself before the nasi. However, reluctantly, but he did. Ki samchua the Rabbi Zeira, when he actually gave smicha to Rabbi Zeira, shalei hachi, the women sang for him, lo kachal, velo sarak, velo pirkus. This is a song that they normally sang for the kala, and over here they sang it for Rabbi Zeira. The kala doesn't need makeup, she doesn't need eyeshadow, she doesn't need blush, she doesn't need mousse for her hair, but yela tchein, and yet she still finds favor in people's eyes. That the kala, kalana'a v'chasuda, is the way that a kala is seen or viewed, and she doesn't need any adornment in order to have that chesed or that chain that is associated with her. And so too over here, they were saying the same thing about Rabbi Zeira, that he doesn't need any externalities to give him that state of chain, but he's an individual who is naturally has that chain to him, just like a kala also naturally has a chain to her. Kisamchu al Rabbi Ami v'Rabbi Asi, Sharulahu, they sang for them, Hachi, Komandain, Komandain. Anyone like them, Chusam Chulana, they should give smicha to. I mean, the people appropriate like yourselves, they should give smicha to. Lotis Mechulana, the people that you shouldn't give smicha to are Lomi Misar Matim, Lomi Misar Misim. So Rashi over here translates these two as one of them from the word of the Shoresh, Sares, which means to change around or to flip around. So these Sarmisim are people who change around the halachot, or they do the wrong thing because they're not appropriate for a smicha. And the Sarmitim is like a smartut, like a rag, which means that we don't give it to people who are not appropriate, people who are not of a stature and of an erudition that deserves smicha. Vamila, some say lo mechamasim, below mitur misim. Don't give us these types of individuals. Rashi says, tumisim loit paresh. I don't know what that word means.
Others say that it means that the person is half-baked, or they've only learned a small amount of the material that they need to cover. And there are others that suggest that all of these words are words from foreign languages, basically poking fun at individuals who are not well-versed in the halakha, and therefore they pronounce words or they say these items and show their inability to be proper judges in this situation.
Lo machmisim is individuals who hold back from saying over the Tamei Torah, from saying over things that they know in Torah, which is that they're just not knowledgeable. They can't explain things in the Torah because they don't have the knowledge base with which to do it. So they were saying that when Rabbi Ami and Rabbi Asi were given that ordination, that that's what we want. We want people who are worthy to get ordination because that will work out. Then these individuals will be able to explain, to adjudicate, and do the right thing, and not give it to those people that are inappropriate. Rabbi Abahu, Kiava Ate Mimitifta Lebe Kesar. Rabbi Abahu, when he used to go from the yeshiva to the house of the Caesar, Aria, I don't think it literally means the Caesar, but rather the provincial governor of that area of Judea. So the Roman installment over there, he was close with them, or he had relationships with them. Nafke Matronita, the matrons used to come out, the Beit Kesar, the matrons of the Caesar's house or palace, Umishayinle, and they used to sing, Rabo de Ame, a great one of his people, Midabarna de Umte, a leader of his nation, Botsina de Nohora, like a shining candle, Brich Matiech l'Shalom, Baruch Bolacha l'Shalom, your coming should be in peace. So here they were dealing with Rabbi. First of all, he was a leader amongst his people. He was a person of great stature in terms of his erudition and his Talmud Chacham that served the Jewish people, and he was the Nasi. Number two is that he was also, as Rashi notes over here, not only involved in the Jewish matters, but also in the government affairs as well. And that's what they meant, that he's a midarbana, is manhik, parnes v'karov l'machut. He was a wealthy individual, close to the government, or maybe even served in an official capacity for the government. That's what it means, that he was not only a leader amongst his people, but a leader of the nation. And Botsina de Nahora is the fact that he was known to be extremely beautiful. If you remember the Gemara in Bava Metzia, when we spoke about individuals that had beauty, each one in the later generation was a derivative of the one from the previous generation, Rabbi Abahu appears in that list as being one of the unusually beautiful individuals. That's what they call him, a Botsina de Nahora, which is like a candle of sorts, which means someone who was radiant and had tremendous beauty to him. All right, now the Gemara moves on to the next piece of the Mishnah, which is a Rifat Egla B'Shlosha. That Egla Rufa requires three. The Balei Tosafot over here, it's really, I mentioned it when we did the Mishnah, says that the Arifat Egla is not what needs the individuals or the three here. It is the measuring of the corpse that's found to the closest city. And that's what we're speaking about here. There's no adjudication over here because there's nothing to adjudicate. The question is, which city is considered to be the closest city? And that's what we're speaking about here. You require three individuals, and we'll see who they are or what we need over here in order to do the Egla Rufa. So Gemara says, Tanrabanan, V'yatzuzikenecha v'shoftecha. When you find this corpse that's laying out between the cities, then your zikenim and shoftim will go out. Zikenecha shnaim, that's two, because it's written in plural. Shoftecha shnaim, that's written in plural. Vein beitin shakul, and there's no such thing as an even beitin, musifin alein od echad. So then you add on an additional one to get it to be five. Harikan chamisha, divrei Rabbi Yehuda. So Rabbi Yehuda thinks that Egla Rufa requires five. What's interesting over here is that generally we don't want an even beitin when we're dealing with cases or issues of adjudication, because then you can't have a vote where you have a decisive beitin because you could have a stalemate. But in this case, with Egla Rufa, there's no judgment. There's no decision-making over here. I mean, they are measuring, but you would assume that they would come to a consensus and there wouldn't be an argument about it. And so therefore, the requirement for a Beit Din Shakul, not to be a Beit Din Shakul, is a little interesting over here. So either you have to say that it's just the paradigms, which is that once we establish that a Beit Din in general can't be an even number, then we apply it to anything that Beit Din is involved with, even if that particular issue is not affected by it being an even or an odd-numbered Beit Din. Or you could say, it seems a little more far-fetched, is that if you do have a disagreement about which city the corpse is closer to, in the measuring process that comes out there's a disagreement, then you'd want an odd number of individuals to come to some decision about the matter. Although that seems less likely. Rishim Omer Zikenecha Shnaim, that's two. Vein Beitin Shakul, Mosifin Aleinu Dechad, Harikan Shlosha, that's three. And obviously then, Rabbi Shimon would be the author of that position in our Mishnah that says three. Rabbi Shimon, Hai Shoftecha, Mayav Dilei. If he darshan zikenecha to teach you too, then what does he do with Shoftecha? How mi baile the miyuchadim shibishoftecha? That's to teach you that it has to be from amongst the unique ones of your judges. Or in essence, it has to be someone that came from the Sanhedrin HaGedolah. Rabbi Yehuda, mizignei zikenecha nafka. Says it could have said the plural zikenim without saying zikenecha. I could have said ziknei. That says ziknecha, that teaches you both things. It both teaches you the plurality, which means two, and also teaches you that you have to be miyuchadim. Rabbi Shimon, im ziknei, avamina ziknei ashuk. You just had the word ziknei, I would have thought that just means elderly individuals. Katav rachmana zikenecha. Therefore the Torah writes zikenecha to teach you that it can't just be any zakein or any elderly individual. It has to be zikenecha who are, in a sense, unique, that have this status of being Talmidei Chachamim. If you just wrote Zikenecha, Hava Mina Sanhedrin Ktana, then it would be sufficient to take anybody from a Sanhedrin Ktana from the 23 member Bati Dinim, or some Talmud Chochum would be fine. Katav Rachmana Vishoftecha. So then they have the additional requirement of Shoftecha, Mimyuchadim Shoftecha, that they have to come from the Sanhedrin Agdola in Yerushalayim. Rabbi Huda, what is Rabbi Huda going to do with that? He has the same problem that Rabbi Shimon is basically pointing out over here, which is not only do you need Shoftecha, but you also need Zikneicha. So how does he know that? So Gemara answers, Rabbi Huda Gamar Ziknei from Yisamchu Ziknei Ayida. He learns that Gzeira Shava of Zikenim from the Zikenim that are required by the Paralem Davar Shel Tzibur, and the Zikenim that we have over here by the Egla Rufa. And so over there it says, Misamchu Ziknei Ayida Yudahem, Malahalan Miyuchadim Shebe Ayida. Over there by Baalem Davar Tzibur, Shel Tzibur, there's a requirement that it be three individuals from the Sanhedrin Agdola. Avkam Yuchadim Shebzikenecha, so to over here, it's the same requirement. So the Gemara says, okay, if you're going to learn that Gzereshava, Leilith Kula Mihatam, learn from there everything. Zikenecha Veshoftecha Lomid. And why do you need the words of Zikenecha Shoftecha by Egla Rufa at all? You're going to learn everything out from the Gzereshava, and then you don't need the words here at all. So that can't be the explanation, because then we have nothing to do with these words. They all become extraneous. Ella, vav de shoftecha l'minyana. The vav in front of shoftecha tells you to add it on, or to say that there's an additional numbering over here. So when it says zikenecha v'shoftecha, so then you can darshan what Rabbi Shimon says, which is ziknei, and then ziknecha teaches you not just elderly people, but individuals who are from the Sanhedrin. Maybe not the Gdola, maybe Ktana. And the Shoftecha tells you that they have to be representatives of the Sanhedrin Agadol. So Yehuda will learn that same way as Rabbi Shimon, but he also says the Vav of Zikenecha Vishoftecha, that Vav of Chibur connects the Shoftecha to the Zikenecha to tell you that not only do they have to be Miuchadim from the Sanhedrin Agdola, but they also now are a cause for an additional members on this Beit Din, which means you have to have another two. Not just two, but another two, which is four. And then you have a one that's added to make sure that it's not a Beit Din Shakul. Okay, Rabbi Shimon, Vav lo Dorish. Rabbi Shimon doesn't subscribe to that because he's not Dorish the Vav. Over here, the Baalei Tosafot say something that I already mentioned earlier in the Masechta, that the Baalei Tosafot say this many places in Shas. When you have an individual or Tana that says that he's not Dorish the Vav, that is not a blanket statement about his position all over Shas. That doesn't mean Rabbi Shimon will never be Dorish the Vav. Or it doesn't mean that Rabbi Huda, in this case, who is Doresh, the Vav will be Doresh everywhere else in Shas that same way. He points out the Baalei Tosafot examples of that where their opinions differ. But he says whenever a Tana says that, whenever an Amora says that, they're speaking about in this particular case, in this particular location, they don't believe that the Vav should be darshaned, whether that's because they have a Masora, or whether that's because they believe that the Vav in this case is not extraneous, or is not in need of a drasha. But for whatever reason is, in this particular location, Rabbi Shimon believed that the Vav was not open or sufficient for the drasha, whereas Rabbi Yehuda believes that it is. Eliato, if that's the case, v'yatzu shnayim, umadadu shnayim. If you're going to tell me that the verbs that we're using, the fact that they're in plural, impact on the number of shoftim that you need, or people you need involved here, then it says over there, v'yatzu, they will go out in plural, umadadu, and they will measure. So Rabbi Yehuda, hari tish'ah. For Rabbi Yehuda, that would be another four on top of the five that he already requires. It would be nine, and there would be Shimon Shiva. It should be seven. So why don't you be dashing Shoftecha, Zekenecha? What about the description over here of Yatsu and Madudu, which should add another four individuals? So Gemara says, Haumi Bayele the Ketanya. We need that for this breakta. Yatsu, Hein Velo Shluchan. They have to go out, them, and not their messengers or proxies. I mean that literally, the Dayanim have to go out. And the requirement that they come from the Sanhedrin Agdola, that they physically have to come out. They can't send anybody to replace them or to represent them over there. Umadudu, shafilu nimtza ba'alil. They have to measure it, even if it's found ba'alil le'ir, obviously within the city limits, or what otherwise would be the tchum of the city, tzirich lasok b'midida. We still require them to do the measurement. So even if it's self-evident that this corpse that they found is closest to this city, and you don't even have to measure it, you can see that it's closest, still, there's still a despite that, there's still a requirement of actually physically measuring it, even though the answer is known up front. Now, that might be because the Zakenim have to get involved in the process, and therefore, we want them, you know, physically engaged in this matter, or it's because we want to generate more publicity surrounding the matter, and their participation and their doing this will create more publicity. And that publicity hopefully will bring out Edim who can tell us what happened over here or can incriminate whoever it is that killed this individual. Ramar says now, Matnitan Beloki Haitano. Our Mishnah is not like the following Tanya. The Tanya, Rabbi Lezer ben Yaakov Omer, Biatzu Zikenecha Vishovtecha, Zikenecha Zusanhedrin, Vishovtecha Zem Melech Vikoen Gadol. So there's a requirement here, not only that the Sanhedrin go out, or members of the Sanhedrin go out, there's also a requirement that the king and the Kohen Gadol join in this process of Egla Arufa. Melech Dichtiv, Melech B'Mishpat Yamid Eretz, that a king in justice will keep the land straight or be a foundation for the land. So there you see the word Mishpat, and which we're going to connect to Shoftecha being used by a Melech, and then by the Kohen Gadol Dichtiv, Ubala Kohanim Valevim, Ela Shofet, and so you see here that the Kohanim and Levim are connected to the Shofet, and so therefore there's a requirement of the Kohen Gadol. And even though, as Tosafot points out, there were other things in our Mishnah that do not mention all the parties that need to be involved, so over here too, you could just say our Mishnah didn't mention all the parties that were involved. Here it's different because in the other cases where we say they didn't mention all the parties involved, that's because it said that they required the Sanhedrin Agdolah. And those were all instances or issues where the Sanhedrin Agdolah was required. And that was the focus of that part of the Mishnah, which is the Sanhedrin Agdolah. So yes, those issues required other people like the Melech or the Kohen Gadol or the Meshuach Milchama, whoever else had to be a part of that decision process. But the Mishnah is focused on the Sanhedrin Agdolah. In our case, when you're speaking about three individuals or five individuals that need to be involved in this situation, then, if there were additional parties that needed to be there, you would need to say that. We're not talking about the whole Sanhedrin or the Sanhedrin Agdolah as a whole. We're talking about some derivative of it, three or five individuals. Or we're telling you what you need in order to do this. If you're going to do that already, you need to explain all the parties or all the people that were necessary. And therefore, the Mishnah should have at least mentioned the Melech and Kohen Gadol if they are requirements. And for that reason, the Gemara concludes that our Mishnah cannot be like Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov. Yivailu, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, b'chada palik or b'tarte palik. His argument on the Tana of our Mishnah, is it in one area or in two areas? B'melech v'kohen gadol palik. Does he only disagree with the necessity for the king and the kohen gadol to be involved? Aval b'sanhedre ikra b'yuda ikra b'shimon. But with regards to the number of members of the Sanhedrin that have to be present, he'll either paskin like Rabbi Huda, which is five, or like Rabbi Shimon, that it is three. So he's only arguing on this one point as to the additional individuals that have to be there, but he doesn't argue about the number of the Sanhedrin that have to be there. Odilma, b'sanhedrei nami palik. Or maybe he argues even about the number of members of the Sanhedrin that have to be there. Damar, kula sanhedrei b'inon. That he requires the entire Sanhedrin to be there. From the statement that he made, that sounds like the simplest way to read what he says, which is that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov requires that the Sanhedrin, the Kohen Gadol, and the Melech be there. These each represent the power bases or leadership of certain aspects of Klal Yisrael. So then the requirement for each of them to be there, the Kohen Gadol, the Melech, would then include the entire Sanhedrin. And so that's the question the Gemara is posing here. Does he require, does he argue on this point that he requires the entire Sanhedrin to be there? So Amar Rav Yosef, Tashma. We can prove it from here. Matzan Abeit Pagi. If he found them, he bumped into the Sanhedrin by Beit Pagi. Beit Pagi seems to be a location that was near the city limits of Yerushalayim. It's a place in which you could still eat Kodeshim, Maisur Sheni, things that needed or required to be brought up to Yerushalayim, because it was considered to be within the walls of Yerushalayim. So here the Sanhedrin Agdolah is walking out of the city, out of this area, and they bump into what is the Zakein Mamre, which is what they're speaking about there. It's the rebellious elder. It's an elder who holds a different opinion, has paskin that opinion, and now is being told by the Sanhedrin Agdolah that he has to cease and desist from acting in this way or paskin in this way. If he doesn't listen and he continues to violate the word of the Sanhedrin, then he'll be put to death as a Zakein Mamre. So this question here is where the Beit Din is walking out. They're not seated in the court. They're walking out, but they happen to be together. And then Vimra Lehem. The Zakein Mamre basically holds his position or disagrees with them despite their voting against his position. Yochol Tehei Hamrato Hamra'a. You would think his rebellion at this point would be a successful rebellion, or he'd be classified as a Zakein Mamre. Tamalomar Vikamto Valita Lamakom. That you have to go up to the place. Here it's speaking about, in order to get things straightened out or adjudicated, you have to go up to the place. Mlamed Shamakom Goreim. From this you learn that the place itself is important in the functioning of the Beit Din. So if the Beit Din is not in place, then they're not considered to be the Beit Din, or the Sanhedrin HaGdolah is not in its place in Lishkat HaGazit, they don't have the status of the Sanhedrin HaGdolah. So that's true for a number of items. When they left the Lishkat HaGazit, the Gemara tells us that they no longer adjudicated capital cases anymore, or murder cases anymore, because they consider themselves to be out of what would be the area that would give them that right. In addition, over here, Zakein Mamre would not have application, because there's only a concept of Zakein Mamre when he comes up. When you go to the place where Hashem dwells, the place where Hashem is present, and the place where the Sanhedrin Gdolah sits in Lishkat HaGazit. And if you're not there, then you're not considered to be or classified as a Sanhedrin Gdolah. So here, when they are leaving Yerushalayim, they're walking out together as a group, and then the Zakein Mamre bumps into them, despite the fact that the Sanhedrin's there, there's a failure because the Sanhedrin HaGdolah is not seated, is not in the place where they're normally found. Now, Gemara says, Dinafi Kamo. This is where Rabbi Yossi's proof is. How many people left? How many of the Sanhedrin HaGdolah are present as they're going out of Yerushalayim and bump into the Zakein Mamre? Ilem of Miksatan, if you say it was only a portion of them, Dilma Hanach Deika Gavai Kaime Kavate. Maybe those people who are back in the Sanhedrin or still sitting in the Sanhedrin don't agree with the view of the Sanhedrin, but rather agree with this individual, this Zakein Mamre. And now you find support in the Beit Din HaGadol and the Sanhedrin HaGdolah. Now, what's interesting here is that even if you know the Rov, you have the majority of the Sanhedrin that is out there, we would still say the same thing, which is that despite the fact that you have a Rov, if there's a minority that's back behind, we worry about that minority. Now, if they came to a psak halacha based on majority, that minority would have no bearing on the situation. So what you have to say here is that, number one, the rov, and we've discussed this before, that when you have a rov that's going up against a miut, by the Beit Din, it's possible that the rov wipes out the miut entirely. That's only true if they sit as a Beit Din as a whole. So in that case, the rov can then override the miut and make it as if it's a unanimous decision. That's only true if they're not doing things that are disparate, in that you have some that are out of the Beit Din and some sitting in the Beit Din. The second thing is that the possibility that the minority might be able to convince the majority to change their position, or at least a portion of them to change their position. And so given that, we don't want to be paskening about a Zakein Mamre when they're not all present. Ela pshita denafikulu. Their whole Beit Din, the whole Sanhedrin HaGdolah is there. Lamai, why do you have a situation in which the entire Sanhedrin is walking out the same way out of Yerushalayim, or they're all going together or traveling to some location? And Tosfot over here points out, it can't be that they're just going home for the day, because then everybody wouldn't be walking in the same direction and then going out of the city in the same way. Everybody going to their house. They would disperse. They wouldn't be all together. The fact that you're finding them all together in a single location means that they must be going in a purposeful manner to a certain destination. Ileima, l'davar rishut. If you say that they're going out for personal matters or some optional matters, mi matzi nafke, can they really go out? V'aktiv, the pasuk says, sharirich agana sahar, al yechsar amazig. Your navel is like a round goblet, and that has no mixed wine missing from it, or no diluted wine missing from it. So Gemara Darshins, we know from the sharirich agana sahar, is that references to the Sanhedrin that sat in semicircles around like that of the Goan or the threshing floor. And so there, this references to the Beit Din. And over here we say, Al-Yachsar Mazeg, is that you can't have the diluted amount be missing. And so the way that dilution of wine happened in their day was you had one part wine to two parts water. And even as though the Baal Yitzchak point out that in many places we see that the dilution mixture was one part wine to three parts water, he said that that was the weaker type of wine, and that was the dilution that Rova used to do. But the standard type of dilution was one part wine to two parts water. And so in essence, it's saying here, muzik of the dilution of the wine is that you can't have two-thirds of the Beit Din missing. You need to have a minimum of 23 left behind in the Sanhedrin HaGdolah at any given time. They can't all leave at once. You need to leave behind minimal members. And they get that from this idea of the dilution, which is that if the dilution is one part wine to two parts water, then two-thirds of them could leave, but one-third must remain in place. And so out of a Beit Din of 71, if you divide that by three, you get 23 plus the two left over. But speaking about here, that you have to have at least the 23 members that are left behind. Others say that it comes from the gematria of the word mezeg, which is 50. And so if you take the 71 minus the 50, that would leave you with 21 individuals that have to be left behind. And then, because we know you have to have a majority of two, Eidah has to be, then you would get to a number of 23.
Or that 50 is problematic, and therefore you can only have 49 that leave, leaving you with 22, and then you can't have an even baked in, so that results in a number of 23 that need to remain behind, or the amount of a regular Sanhedrin Kitana.
But either way, you have to leave people behind, so you can't have the whole Sanhedrin Agdola walking out of the city for whatever matter that they're looking into. Elipshita l'dvar mitzvah. The only way they would have permission to all leave is if there was a mitzvah to do. Hey, chidami, what is the mitzvah that they're all going out to perform? Lav de midat egla, arufa, must be to go deal with an issue of egla arufa, Rebbe Elazar ben Yaakov, and that's the opinion of Rebbe Elazar ben Yaakov. So what we see here is that he requires the entire Sanhedrin to come out, because that would be an instance or a case where you'd have the entire Sanhedrin going out. Damar kule Sanhedrin beina, because he thinks you need all the Sanhedrin in order to deal with egla arufa. Amar le Abaye, lo, maybe not. Kagon shiatzulo sif aleir valazarot. Maybe the case here is that they're going out to expand the limits, the city limits of Yerushalayim, or to expand the azarot. Both of those include a level of kedusha that is required for certain performance of mitzvot or for the korbanot. And the only way to expand those limits, both on the azarot and the mikdash, as well as the city limits, is to have the Beit Din Agadol participate in it. So Bai says, maybe that's what they were doing. They were going to Hosif Alayir or Lazarot. Kiditznan. Emosifim Alayir. Valazarot. Elo Beitin Shel Shivim Be'echad. Like we saw in our Mishnah, that you require a Beitin of 71 in order to expand the city limits or the Kedusha of the city. So that could be the possibility of why they're going out, is because of that. Tanya Kavati the Rav Yosef. We have a bright that it supports Rav Yosef's contention over here. Matzana Beit Pagi. Vihimra Alehem. He finds them, the Zaki Mari finds them out by Beit Pagi, and he refuses to accept their position when he speaks to them there. Kagon Shiatsu. Why were they there in Beit Pagi? Because they were going out. Medidat Egla Rufa, or the Hosif Aleir Valazarot. In order to deal with an issue of measuring an Egla Rufa, as well as to add on to the city or the Azarot. It is also a proof to Abaye, but it's a proof to Rav Yosef, because in the bright that includes an opinion that thinks you need the entire Sanhedrin to deal with Egla Rufa. And the only person we found that has that type of opinion or possibility of that opinion is Rebbe Elazar ben Yaakov. And for that reason, you would believe that Rebbe Elazar ben Yaakov requires the entire Sanhedrin to participate in Egla Rufa. Yocho Shetei Amrato Hamra'a. You would think the Zakein Mamre over there, who refused to accept the authority of the Beit Din HaGadol, would be then subject to the din of a Zakein Mamre there. Tamalomar Bekamto Valita Lamakom Lamecha Makom Goreim. In fact, what we said before, that only when the Beit Din is in place, in its proper place, in the Lishkat HaGazit, does this din apply. And therefore, a Zaken Mamre cannot become a Zaken Mamre, Elaim Ken, he refuses to accept the authority of the court, or their Psak Halacha, when he's there, in the Lishkat HaGazit, where the Sanhedrin sits. Right now, the Gemara continues, Neta Ravai, Umasir Sheni, She'ein Damav Yiduim Bishlosha. The Neta Ravai, Umasir Sheni, where it's not easy to evaluate what the item is, or the value of the item, you require three individuals for the assessment of the value. So now the Baal Tosafot point out over here, and we mentioned this in the Mishnah as well, which is that Neter Ravai is not qualified by this. Neter Ravai requires three people every time, partly because it doesn't recur so many times, doesn't happen so often. Number two is that the person's so excited to eat his new fruit, so even though they have a din like Maaser Sheni, they have to be redeemed, he might go easy on the assessment of the value redeeming them. So therefore we want impartial parties to deal with Neter Ravai, because over there, there's a higher likelihood of mistake to be made. Then, by Maaser Sheni, individuals have a right to redeem their Maaser Sheni by themselves, except in cases where, in the Mav Yuduim, where their value is not clear. And the Gemara is going to ask, what is that? Tanu Rabbanan, Ezu Maaser Sheni Ish in the Mav Yuduim. What's an example? What are examples of Maaser Sheni where their value is not known? Peirot, shir kivu. It's fruits that have spoiled or have started to spoil. Yayin, shir krim. Wine that has coagulated on the top or is an indication of the production or turning of it into vinegar. Umaot, shechlidu. Or coins or money that has rusted. So all of these are items that people might accept, but they would only accept them at a discount. And the question, what's the proper assessment of the value that we have here? So in all these cases, they don't trust the individual to evaluate it because it's difficult. This is something that has a certain amount of subjectivity to it, and you would need experts to tell us what the real price is in these situations. Therefore, Tanu Banan, Maaser Sheni Ein Damav Yiduim, Potino To Bishlosha Lekuchot. You require that you have three
Lukuchot, the way Rashi writes Lukuchot doesn't mean literally buyers, but three individuals who are tagarim, who are traders, who are experts in evaluation. These are merchants or traders, and we want them to do the assessment. Avalo bishlosha, chain Lukuchot, but you can't do it with three that don't have that expertise. Because over here, that's exactly what we're trying to figure out. These difficult items, how do we assess their value? And so the only way to do that is to get experts in here to help us with the situation. You don't have experts, you can't do that. Afilo nachri echad mehem. Requirement for three doesn't mean that you need three Jews. It means you can even have a non-Jew on there. And you can even have the owner himself on there. We want a certain amount of impartiality. So we want impartiality plus expertise. So if we get certain individuals who are experts, even though, again, they may not be Jewish, or even though they are nogeba dabar like the Balim, nevertheless, they can be included in this group of three that's going to assess the value. Then the Balei Tosafot here read the requirement of Lukuchot, not to mean Tagarim like Rashi, but literally buyers of the item. You need people who are willing to pay and buy this item off, or be a part of an auction in which they would bid for it and what their bid levels would be. So that makes it much more practical, which is that these individuals are willing to buy this item, and we want three individuals who are willing to buy it to put up a price. So then we would know or understand what the assessment was. Again, Rashi thinks it just means tagarim. People have that type of expertise, but not that they're literally going to buy what we have here. So, Bayi Rabbi Yirmiya, shlosha mitilim tokis echad mahu. We have three partners who are partners in business transactions. Are they considered to be like one unit, or are they considered to be like three individuals? You have three individuals with an expertise, but they are, in a sense, a single unit because they're on business together, so they think the same way and they would evaluate things the same way. So Tashma, Ish Ushtenashav, an individual and his two wives. So that means here you needed that minimum of a three can comprise of an individual and his two wives. So obviously an individual and his two wives are partners in their business or in their monetary matters. So Podim Masir Sheni Shindam Avyudinim. They have the right to redeem Masir Sheni, whose monetary value is not well known. If that's the case, then you see from here that you can have three individuals who are in a partnership do this evaluation. My answer is Dilma could go in Rav Papa, but Abba Surah. Maybe that's like Rav Papa and his wife, who was the daughter of Abba Surah. But Rav Papa's wife was a wealthy woman who also was in business, and she supported herself. She didn't take from her husband, and therefore she didn't give to her husband. She was running an independent business over there, an independent bank account. And so then maybe that's what the Gemara is saying. You can have a man and his two wives, but his two wives are like Bat Abasura, where they are independently wealthy, independent merchants, or independently in business, and their husbands are not necessarily supporting them. Therefore, that heter to use person as two wives would not extend to a partnership, because this was a unique circumstance. What the right to speaking about there is a case that you cannot extrapolate to explain other cases of partnerships. Where it says, like, they showed bishlosha. That when it comes to redemption of hekdesh, you require three individuals. Matnita and Deloki Aitana. Our mission is not like this Tana. The Tani, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov Omer, Afilu Tzinora shel hekdesh. Even a small fork of hekdesh, Tzricha Asara bnei Adam liftota, requires 10 people in order to redeem it and to assess the value. Again, here our mission says hekdesho bishlosha, that you only require three individuals, and here Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is requiring 10, and that's why he can't be the author of our Mishnah. Now, in terms of Tzinora, Tzinora is a metal item with like a hook at the end, or functions like a fork of some sort. It appears in the Gemara in different contexts, and in those different contexts, as the Bayit Tosfot point out, it has different meanings. So sometimes it means a fork or a type of hook that you use to turn over the limbs on the Mizbeach for the Korbanot. Another fork that they speak about here is something which was a sharp piece of metal that was curved at the end that they used for stitching or for sewing. Or there's also a Tzinora that was used for separating out things or plucking things away. So again, it seems like an item that's bent at the end that has some sort of like little hook on it, but it was used in different functions depending on its size and depending on its context. But the idea being here that the Tzinora here is a small item. And despite the fact of being a small item, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov requires 10 assessors in order to get its value. And that would go against our Mishnah's position, which is that it is three. And that's why the Gemara says he can't be the author of our Mishnah. So I'm a little popular by Bishlam, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, Damar Kishmuel. I understand Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov's position that anytime you redeem Hekdesh, you require 10 individuals, because he's going to hold like Shmuel, Damar Shmuel, Asara, Kohanim,
Tuvim b'parsha. The word Kohen appears in those parshiot 10 times. It's actually a combination of 3 parshiot. Parshia of Arachin. It's the parshia of redeeming animals, kosher and non-kosher animal that was sanctified, as well as the redemption of Karka. And those 3 parshiot, if all together, the word Kohen is mentioned 10 times. And that's how Shmuel learns the requirement for 10 individuals to redeem an item. So that would be true by Karka Oat. That's the way that Shmuel learns it. What we're saying over here is that now we understand also the position of Elazar ben Yaakov. Elazar ben Yaakov acquires 10, says that this redemption of Metaltalin is found in that section of those parshiot. And since they're all together, I would assume you have the same rulings, which is they all require 10 in order to have it redeemed. El Rabbanan Shlosha Menaluhu. It turns out that Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov is easier to understand. If we require 10 by the redemption of Karka, we should require 10 by everything, because the word Kohen or Kohanim that is mentioned there is spread across all these different matters, not just by Karka. Then we say the same should be with Metaltalin. That's because by the Behemoth, or the redemption of Ekdesh, there are 3 Kohanim mentioned there. Karka, Tichtibu, Arba'ah, Tizkei, Arba'ah. That's the way you're going to do it. Then Karka, then only have the word Kohen or Kohanim mentioned 4 times, you should be able to deal them with 4 people. If you say, yeah, that's right, Karkot only need 4. Allah matzana, Karkot tisha v'kohen. Our Mishnah says that when it comes to Karkot, the redeeming of Karkot, you need 10, 9 lay people and 1 kohen. But we still have a requirement of 10. Elamai, dimishalme behu asara. So what are you going to tell me? Because Karkot are the last thing mentioned in that list. So therefore, they accumulate all the words of Kohanim that were mentioned before. And that accumulation makes it, if you have 10 for Karkot, then Hekdeshot, dimishalme behu shita. Then Hekdeshot, which is the middle stuff, you have Arachin first, then you have the redemption of Behemot, Meot, Torot, and then you have Karkot. So Karkot, that in the end, you're going to tell me they need 10 individuals because they cumulatively have 10 times that the word Kohen is mentioned. Then by the redemption of Metaltalin, which is in the Parshia before, you should have at least 6 because you have those that accumulated from Arachin and in the Parshia of the Metaltalin. So then why wouldn't you have at least need the Mishalmi Bo's Shita, Libayu Shita? You should acquire at least 6. Gemara leaves that as a kasha. That's an unresolved issue. We do not know where the Chachamim got their position from, as to 3. We know where Rav Elazar ben Yaakov got his 10 from, because he's consistent, that anything mentioned in those parshiot would require 10. But Chachamim require 3 by Metaltalin and 10 by Karkaot. We know where 10 and Karkaot come from Shmuel, but we don't know where the 3 come from with regards to Metaltalin that you are redeeming. All right, we're going to stop here by the 2 dots on the bottom of Yudalit Amud Bet.